Right. I'm Morgan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Morgan.
It's good to be here. Thank you for asking me to speak. I always appreciate it when I'm invited to speak. I apologize for running in right at start time. I hope to chat with some of you all after the meeting, but it's funny. My husband told me a while back that he was planning on being out of town for a guy's weekend for this weekend. And so upon hearing this news, I immediately came up with all kinds of plans on how I was going to spend this glorious weekend to myself, which, if you know me at all, a lot of you don't, primarily involves like 12 to 14 straight hours of Netflix binging per day and Pisano's pizza delivery on speed dial, so I don't have to leave my couch. Generally just checking out from the world for a couple of days. That's my idea of a good time. And God knows what I need and knows what's best for me. And first I got a call from a friend asking me to speak on step 11 at her home group yesterday morning. And then I had a sponsee reach out and tell me she was ready to schedule her long overdue fifth step for this weekend. So we did that yesterday, and I had a sober friend asked me to accompany her to a medical thing she's going through. And then of course I got the call from my new friend Dale, who asked me to come to Madison, Virginia, a place far, far away that I had never heard of to speak to you guys. So all of my plans and designs for my selfish weekend were out the window, and I've had a wonderful weekend filled with recovery and service and participating in life and connection and getting to know my friend Noah here better on the drive down. And that's what this program does for me, is like, despite myself, despite my ideas, Alcoholics Anonymous provides me with an opportunity for a better life if I choose to take it, if I say yes. I don't, not only do I not have to drink today, but I don't have to live in my natural state, that is isolation from my fellows and misery and depression. I can show up for the alcoholic when called to do so and show up for life today. So that's what I mean when I say I'm glad to be here. I have a sobriety date. It's September 7, 2014. On that date, I didn't quit drinking. I didn't put the bottle down. I was separated from alcohol by a power greater than myself, which I'll talk about in a little bit. I have a sponsor. She lives in Michigan, so I don't see her much, but we talk and text, stay connected. And in my story, I'll mention a sponsor on a number of occasions. And just so it's clear, I had a couple of sponsors the first couple years of my sobriety just because of circumstances. And the one I have now, I've had for about 7 years or so. I also sponsor other women, and we go through the steps as they're outlined in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our basic text. And I have a home group, and it's a women's line by line big book study. It means we read line by line, and then anyone can jump in and share at any time. It's a women's meeting. It's up in the Fairfax Chantilly area. So if you're a woman and ever up that way and are interested in attending, please see me after the meeting. We love having new faces, and I think we're a really good group. So Monday nights. And so speaker meetings, generally I tend to hear what it's like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'll kind of try to stick to that. I was born and raised in a Northern Virginia suburb. I had two parents, an older brother, a relatively normal childhood, if you will. My parents, they each definitely had their own isms, but I was taken care of to the best of their ability, and I was safe and secure, and I just never felt that way. Like, I remember being so full of fear as a child, and There was no outward reason for that. What I mean is, I remember being a kid and going around at night in our house and making sure all the doors and the windows were locked, just so I would feel safe. And it's not like we had a theft or a burglary issue in my neighborhood. I was so afraid of natural disasters. Like, I was convinced every time it started storming that our house was going to get struck by lightning. And, again, it wasn't like I had a friend whose house was struck by lightning. Like, there was no apparent reason for all this fear. And I have this one memory. I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years old. And I just broke down in tears randomly, full waterworks, to my mom. And she's like, what's wrong? Like, what's up? And I remember saying to her, you don't love me. Like, you don't really love me. And it wasn't like a bratty thing. Like, it's not like she had just refused to buy me a toy or, she just yelled at me. It was just, I just remember it coming from this deep-seated feeling of discontent, like not being okay, not being cared for, not being safe. And I know today, like, that was my spiritual malady from the beginning. And my story is just my spiritual malady, like, manifesting itself over and over in different forms. As I got a little bit older, I guess people call me a late bloomer in terms of picking up a drink. I didn't pick up a drink until I was like 18 and off at college. So prior to that, in my earlier teen years, I had a eating disorder. I had severely restricted eating. I was an exercise addict. I was, counting calories, had to run X number of miles a day. I was a perfectionist, a straight A student. I was valedictorian in my high school, editor in chief of my school newspaper, like all that. And it looked really good on the outside. Like, I was praised for my self-discipline and my accomplishments and my intelligence. And eventually I started getting comments on how thin I was, so I had to sort of work my way around those and manipulate my eating so it looked like I just had a really good metabolism. And it was all about control for me, and just getting getting the next thing. Like, if I just run one more mile, like, then I'll be okay. Or, if I just lose 1 more pound, like, then I'll be good. Again, my spiritual malady, right? Like, never being truly content, always chasing. And my junior year of high school, my older brother Greg got into a car accident, and he totaled his car. And my parents asked him, afterwards what happened. And he said the voices in his head told him to crash into the driver in front of him. And that began a long period of psychosis. And now that was a psychotic break, and it was traumatic to witness, I think, for anybody, but especially because, like, my older brother, I mean, I looked up to him, I admired him. He was so naturally popular and athletic, and but, like, didn't know it, like, humble and just a great brother. So to see this happen to him was, it was trauma. And he there's a lot of scary stuff going on at that time. We didn't know what to expect. He ended up with a schizophrenic diagnosis. So I remember just trying to stay small and not take up any space and not be the kid that anybody had to worry about. And so I doubled down on my behaviors. I got even thinner. I worked even harder. And we didn't really talk about, like, what was going on as a family. And so it was just a lot of blocking out for me. And just trying to kind of shrink away. And soon after that, my parents announced they were getting divorced after like 25, 30 years of marriage, and that was another unexpected for me. And so again, I continued to just try to control when I, what I could, when I felt like everything was outside of my control. And so I went off to college around that time, and I had my first real drink, my first drunk, and I think it was like not even before before classes had even started. And I had had sips like here and there over the years, but I never, because of like my self-discipline and because of my lifestyle, I really never let myself drink before. And I'd also seen the effects of heavy drinking on my parents, and I was like, that's stupid. I'm never gonna go down that road. Mom's throwing up in the morning, like that doesn't look fun. And so, but here I am. I'm off at college, and I'm at a around the world party at a fraternity house, which is like each room is a different country and a different type of alcohol. And I don't know, I think it was somewhere around Ireland where the Guinness just started like to really kick in. I often hear described like the nights that promises came true for us. Like I felt a new freedom and a new happiness. I felt peace and ease. Fear of people left me. I had all the money in the world all of a sudden. I intuitively knew how to handle situations, which used to baffle me. It was magical. I remember telling myself, like, this is what I've been chasing, like with all these other behaviors, like this is it, like I'm finally here, and finally truly content. And I didn't really ease into alcoholic drinking. I pretty much jumped in. I had my first blackout not soon after that, and blackout drinking became the norm for me. But I remember the first time that it happened, I was so, I had never heard of it before, and like that it could happen. And I was so perplexed that I could just lose hours of my memory. Like that was so crazy. But it didn't stop me, it didn't slow me down. My consequences just came hard and fast, and it never really stopped. And I quickly realized that I was different from my peers. We all like to party and have fun, but they were getting up and going to class the next day and going to the gym and, maybe taking the next night off from partying. And for me, alcohol and drinking quickly became the center of my life, and I could not manage the rest of my life. I like that self-discipline I had was out the window. And I couldn't get to class. I couldn't form, maintain healthy habits. I couldn't form meaningful sober relationships. I just like I was preoccupied with like where I could get hammered next. And I was waking up in frat houses and pass out on the lawn or whatever. Eventually I got a DUI down there at school, and my first one. And I took a semester off to kind of tell my parents like I'm gonna get my life together and get some counseling. And I think it's just situational, like the family stuff that's been going on, and I'll get it together. And but eventually I ended up changing schools. I ended up transferring to VCU down in Richmond. And I thought, it'll be a little bit easier. It's like not as demanding of a school, and it'll fit in with my drinking better. And that was the start of my Richmond years. And I lived in what they call the Fan, which is a neighborhood, and there's a bar on every corner, and I lived in them. There's a Cat Power song called "Lived in Bars," and that was me. I think, I think I was desperate for was really desperate for human connection, and because I felt so awkward, like sober, and mostly desperate for connection with men, and I needed alcohol to connect, so the bars made sense for me, and so I was, barely going to class, and had a series of messed up, toxic, codependent, alcoholic relationships. All those guys I met in bars, in the van, and my powerlessness just reached new levels. I would tell myself I was going to go to happy hour at my favorite bar, Joe's. It ran from 3 to 6 p.m. I say, I'm going to go to happy hour, and like when the prices go back up, I'm gonna like stop and come back home. And then the next thing you know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm in some seedy neighborhood buying dry forms of alcohol and missing school and work the next day. Like I was just trying to go to happy hour, and I just I got into more and more dangerous situations. I never knew what was gonna happen. It's amazing what I was willing to put up with in terms of what alcohol did to me in exchange for what it did for me. I'd come to in the middle of the night and I'm stumbling alone in some strange neighborhood, or I'm with some guy I don't know, or I come to and I'm driving in my car and I'm sideswiping all the mirrors on the parked cars. It was just insanity, and I was arrested a few more times, and I was just constantly accepting the consequences because it was just what I had to do. Like it was just what I had to do to keep drinking. It came with the territory, and my bar kept getting lower, and speaking of lowering the bar, like when I first started out drinking, like at those years at William and Mary, I would tell myself, like, okay, if I can get back to my room and wash my face and brush my teeth before bed, like I'm good. That was like my standard. And then it became eventually, if I could just make it back to my room, not even worried about the hygiene anymore. Like I'm good, right? It's been a good night. And then it became, if I can just not end up in jail or a hospital, like it's been a successful night, and yeah, just constantly lowering the bar, and like I knew pretty quick that my drinking was problematic, and that I was probably alcoholic. I really didn't have that issue that a lot of us do, that like we're not admitting that it's a problem. Like I knew it was a problem. I just really didn't have the willingness to give it up because it was serving me. I had a lot of, yeah, so I guess I had a lot of self-awareness in that respect, but it I, one moment I had moments of clarity. One in particular, I came to, or I woke up or whatever, out of like a 3 day bender, and I remember I was so thirsty and dehydrated. I was just dying for like a Gatorade or something. And I woke up and I had nothing. And so there was this coffee shop just down the road from my apartment on the VCU campus. And so I walk over to this coffee shop. It's like 7 in the morning. I'm still drunk. I walk in. I have red wine stains on my shirt. I had like peed myself the night before, so like my jeans were gross. And I look at all these people, and I see put together people who are, reading the newspaper and getting ready for work or school and drinking coffee and talking and laughing, and like their hair is brushed, and I remember like the feeling of separation from my fellows was greater than ever in that moment. I remember looking at these people and being like, how are they just doing normal life? And I knew that I was so far from that. But like for me, self-awareness wasn't a solution. That wasn't enough to get me to stop drinking. And towards the end, I was depressed. I was drunk around the clock. I was drinking alone. I have this memory of being in my apartment, sitting on my floor with my bottle, and Johnny Cash's "Hurt" is playing on repeat, and I'm just sobbing. But I remember having this like knowing that I'm never gonna feel happiness or joy again. Like, it sounds so dramatic, but it was so real for me. You know, like I was like, this is it for me. Like, this life is it for me. And crazily enough, a couple of times I came to, and I woke up or whatever, and I had written notes like in my blackout to my family, like apology notes or almost like suicide notes. Like, I was expecting not to wake up one day soon. And I never, intentionally committed suicide, but it was just like, obviously I'm not gonna get very far in this life, and there's nothing I can do about it. So it's very dark. And I'll kind of jump to, what I want to summarize about my drinking, which is, I could go on with timeline of events and consequences and such, but really there's two things I have to get across. One is that when I drank, I couldn't control the amount that I took. I think that I've covered that part. And the second is when I tried to stop drinking, I could never stay stopped. I was actually court ordered to Alcoholics Anonymous over these years, because of my various charges and such. And I would go to these meetings, and sometimes I would take it more seriously than others, but at times I really did want to turn my life around. Like, I did want to stop drinking, and I didn't like the way that I was living. But I wasn't desperate enough to surrender. And I always drank again after a short period of time. And so what happened is, on September 6, 2014, the last night that I drank, it wasn't like the worst night ever, consequences wise. I was in jail, which by the barometer I gave earlier was not a very good night for me. But I came out of my blackout, and I didn't remember why I had been arrested. And so I asked the guards, why am I in here? And they said, drunk in public. And I remember feeling so thrilled and like relieved, because I had had those before, and I knew that it was just paying a fine. And I knew I had been driving earlier that night. And if it had been a DUI, it would have been my third, and it would have been a felony in Virginia. And so, yet again, I'm lowering my bar, right? Like, it's okay if I end up in jail, as long as it's not a felony, like, we're good, you know? And, but I got out of there. I got out of there that morning, and I have no idea why. But for whatever reason, I was done lowering my bar after that. I don't know why God chose to intervene on that day. But there wasn't any fight left in me. I really was, could not go on getting this beating from alcohol. And I also felt like I couldn't go on not drinking. So there wasn't this firm resolution, like, I got it this time. Like, I'm gonna get my life together. There was none of that. It was more like throwing up my hands and saying, I don't even know anymore. Like, I don't even know what to do here. Like, complete and utter desperation. And su suicide kind of seemed like a attractive option around this point. But I also knew about this AA thing, and I knew it didn't work for me, but I also knew that I had seen it work for a lot of people, and the seed had been implanted for me when I was court ordered. And so God graced me the willingness to reach out to a woman who I knew from that was sober in AA, and it was a Sunday morning, and she asked me to meet her at the Raritan Club in Sterling. And I picked up my 24-hour chip, and she became my sponsor, my first sponsor. And I remember, I'm gonna take a drink of water. Apologize. was a lot of talking. I remember being not quite sure what was going on here. Like, I didn't really get what things like defects of character had to do with not drinking. I still wasn't quite clear on the sponsorship thing. I came from a marketing background, and so I felt like there was an exchange of money going on. I didn't really fully grasp that yet, but I started to listen, and I really wasn't in a place to pass a lot of judgment this time around. I knew that this was the last stop on the block for me, and I knew what was waiting for me if I, if I didn't get the surreal shot this time. So I listened to the suggestions, and I got a number of them. I was told to call women and ask them out for coffee and get a service position and get a home group and do the steps. And I was desperate enough this time to follow the suggestions and to thoroughly follow the path. I sensed at that point that I needed to be fired as the manager of my life. I don't know if I would have said those words, but I had that feeling. And so it was awkward a little bit for me at first. But I did the hard things, and I remember getting this woman's phone number at a meeting. It was like a Sunday night early on, and she gave me her number, and she had a ton of years, and I was super intimidated by her. And she said, "Call me this week." So all week I stared at my phone and I put it off. Friday came around, and Friday was Halloween. So I'm like, I know she has kids, so if I call her like tonight, she's probably not going to answer. So this week, so I called her like Friday at like 6 p.m. On Halloween, and when she answered, she said, "I told you to call me this week, and you did. That's awesome. Your word in AA is starting to mean something." And I felt so like esteemable and validated, like in a healthy way for the first time in a long time, like just from that one little thing. And my sponsor, she kept steps two and three really simple for me. She'd be like, "Okay, you called me, you went to a meeting, you didn't drink today. Like, those weren't your ideas of what to do today. Like, you took somebody else's suggestions. That's step two and three right there." And I needed it to be that simple for me in the beginning because I was really smart, Like, I remember sitting in front of Starbucks going over step two with her, and I said things like, "How can there be a God if there's genocide and rape and murder? How can there be a God if I've seen my brother suffer from this horrible mental illness for so long?" And I was told that I didn't have to figure it out right then and there, and that I didn't have to fully define my higher power my first time through step two and three, and that continuing on with the rest of the steps was enough. So I continued on, and I did a four step, and I learned that if I wanted to stay sober, I no longer had the luxury of blaming others. And that if I was in resentment or I was in fear, that I had a part in putting myself there, or at least I got the ball rolling. And I won't say that I was this magically changed person after the first, fourth, and fifth step. I think it took some time for me to internalize change, but it was at least intellectually like a blueprint for how to start thinking a little differently about my reaction to life circumstances and to other people. I did a sex inventory, and I figured out I was about as addicted to men as I was to alcohol, like using male attention and validation for to feel good as a drug. So it's no surprise that I ended up in a relationship at 2 months sober. Thank God for sponsorship. I think I don't know where I would be without sponsors. And she, sponsor at the time, sat me down and she's like, I'm not the arbiter of your sex conduct. But if you're gonna do this, because I was not gonna stop seeing this guy, she said, if you're gonna do this, if you're gonna like be in this relationship, you are gonna be crazy because you basically have untreated alcoholism right now. And you are gonna need to double down on this program. Like your life already depends on this program. And now you're gonna throw a relationship on top of it at 2 months over. So she's like, you're gonna need your own meetings, your own higher power, your own network. Get through the rest of these steps and start helping other women. And I believed her. I believed her. I believed that I would be crazy. Partly because she had met her husband in early sobriety like 10 years prior. And I'm not endorsing this practice, but it was where I was at and I needed that experience, shared experience, a chain reaction, one alcoholic, like starting with Bill and Bob, Mother's Day 1935, all the way down to me. And I took her direction and I continued on with the steps and I did step six and seven were a slow process for me. I had, as I've hinted at, I had very much the educational variety of spiritual experience. She was right. I was jealous. I was insecure. I was resentful at half of AA. I was gossiping like crazy. But slowly over time, I started to notice that my reactions were getting a little bit, and my actions were getting a little bit healthier. And I think it was because I was sick. I got sick of being sick and self. And, there was this woman who was in the rooms, and I was super, I mean, huge resentment against this woman. And I loved to gossip about her. And after a while, it started to not feel great. And I had a friend, a girl I was friendly with in the rooms, call me up, and she was so excited to tell me that she had found a new sponsor that she liked. And turns out it was this woman that I was super resentful at. I remember being at this crossroads, like, okay, I can say what I really want to say here, which is like gossip and shit talk about this woman, or I can say what my higher power might have me say, which is, I'm happy that you found the sponsor you like, and I hope it works out for you. And I chose the latter. And I remember having such a feeling of freedom. Like I had finally practiced restraint of pen and tongue. I had invited my higher power in to help me act with grace. And it's such a small thing, but I think those are the things, like the little day-to-day interactions that really distinguish a recovered person. And so I think, over time, the acting as if became less acting, like the more that I did that. And the more that I practiced that opposite action, the more that I understood God. The more that I understood that God was this, I think of it like God is this power deep down within me. That's all loving and true. And like a, think of it like a tether, like it's sourced from outside of me. And things like alcohol and ego just like pile up on there and cut the tether. So I'm not connected. I'm out of sync. That's how I come to think about my higher power. And the steps eight and nine, I got to clean up the wreckage of the past. And when I got to this step, the first names that I thought of were my ex-boyfriend and my cute bartenders down in Richmond. I kind of upset with some of my drunken antics. And those are the people that I thought that I had to make amends to. Again, thank God for sponsorship. Like, I think sponsor direction is probably dare I say, like the most crucial here in these steps out of all the steps. Because my motives are so skewed in the beginning. Like my motives on step nine are I want you to not be mad at me anymore and to see how good I'm doing. And so I was encouraged to think about where I really caused the most harm. And then I wrote out scripts, and my sponsor, she took a big red pen and she marked off, like she cut out like 80% of what she called the fluff that I had written. And she said, we stick to giving credit where credit's due. Why are we doing this, Alcoholics Anonymous? We stick to here are the harms that I did. And let me know if I left anything out. And this is what I'm doing to make it right. Is there anything else I can do? By the end of my drinking, I was estranged from my family. My parents really didn't want anything to do with me. I think just the lying and the not showing up, and the emergent calls from jails and hospitals, and not being there for my brother on his journey at all. They just got sick of it, and rightly so, and so when I did the amends, I got to sit them down and look them in the eye and say, I stole your peace of mind. And I've gotten to back that up now with 9 years of showing up. And my brother, I know what's going on in his life today. I know what his boss's name is. I know why he likes his new position at work. My mom is getting married in the spring, and she before she decided to get married, she sat me down and she asked me if I had any concerns about her partner or her getting married. And like, there's trust there today, and my opinion matters. And her fiance doesn't have children in his life, and so he asked me to be his power of attorney. I have a key to their house. Like, it's crazy to think about where we were, versus where we are today, and it's all due to Alcoholics Anonymous, in particular with the ninth step. And so restored relationships with family, friends. Most of my friends today are in these rooms, but I was able to repair a couple of those friendships from the past. And actually, when Dale called me to lead this meeting, I was in Budapest traveling with my husband. And I have this friend who's an old friend from college, from the Louie my Mary years, and he's what they call, I guess, a digital nomad. He can work from anywhere, so he lives anywhere. And he had just flown in to Budapest to meet up with us, and he does that whenever we travel. He'll just kind of meet up with us for a couple of days. And so when Dale called, I was finishing up the day with him. But this friend doesn't have to work. He doesn't have to clean up my messes today. He doesn't have to worry about what's going to happen when I drink. He doesn't have to worry about, as he once was, being accused of drugging me because I passed out right onto the bar from being so drunk in the middle of the day. My friends don't have to worry about that stuff today. And it's a fun and fulfilling friendship. He tells me every day where he is in the world, and that's the kind of stuff that I get to do when I am sober in this program. And steps 10 and 11 are all about incorporating steps thus far and putting them to practice in my daily life. And pausing when agitated or doubtful, inviting my higher power in, seeing my part in things, making prompt amends, and talking about prayer and meditation. I came into this program with no real spiritual or religious background. I was very much atheist, agnostic, and I was like that bratty college kid that, worshipped Nietzsche and would say things like nothing is real and nothing is true, and very jaded. And so I didn't really know what to do with this step, but the big book and the 12 and 12 provide me a lot of direction and great starting points for prayer and meditation. On Awakening, page 86 to 88, I was instructed to read that every day in the beginning. Provides me a great framework for morning meditation and prayer right there. The breakdown of the St. Francis prayer and the 12 and 12, the big book is littered with prayers. I mean, not just in step 11, but in, we have the third step prayer. A lot of us know that, the seven step prayer, the sick man's prayer, and the four step, God save me from being angry. How can I be helpful? This is a sick man. The sex prayer, like there's prayers in the ninth step. So they're everywhere. So that was helpful for me. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing here. And so those were helpful direction for me in the beginning and still are a part of my daily repertoire. And, once we've had the psychic change as a result of these steps, Bill says, like, we can start to trust our intuition. He says in the ninth step, I joked about it earlier, but we can intuitively handle situations which used to baffle us. And then he says in the 11th step, what used to be the hunch or the occasional inspiration gradually becomes a working part of the mind, and that we can come to rely upon it. So as I get time in this program, I can start to differentiate between my self-will and my higher power's will, and not always by myself. Sometimes I need a sponsor or somebody to bounce things off of. But in general, I can go through my day and know when I am with God and when I am not. And when I am not, it feels gross. That's how I know. I'm either really wrapped up in something and ensnared in something. Usually, like, I'm in fear, or I'm feeling too good, and I'm in validation, attention seeking, or pride, or ego. But calm contentment, like where I try to be most of the time. If I'm in that place, I know that the direction I'm receiving is reliable, and that my thoughts then are probably okay. Carrying the message to the next alcoholic, sponsorship has been a journey for me. I was definitely very over invested in some of my earliest sponsees, and that was just a learning process for me. And today I still don't know what I'm doing, but I know that if I stick to sharing my experience, strength, and hope, guiding them through the steps and pointing them back to the book, like, I'm doing my job. And I have seen a lot of newcomers come and go. I'm not in the results business, but I've also seen many newcomers stay. And that sponsee that I mentioned in the very beginning, who I did the fifth step with yesterday, she just got 3 years in August. This was our second time through the inventory. And she's the first sponsee I've had that's gotten multiple years and has stuck with me from the very beginning. And that is, like, the coolest thing when that happens. She's a friend now today too, and so sponsorship can be tricky, and there's so many different suggestions and styles and approaches, and I adopt a lot from my sponsor, obviously, but I also have my own flair and style. And talking about 10 and 11, my sponsor is very much like, hand write your nightly inventory with a pen and paper, like a dedicated notebook, and like follow the format. And I'm like, use all the apps, use all the technology. Like, I don't care, whatever gets you to do it. So we have some differences here and there, but, it's all about the principles. And, that's why I love AA. It's like, no one human power knows it all, right? Like, but collectively we have a lot of wisdom here. And, the fellowship has brought me a lot of joy in my life. My friendships with women have been another journey for me. I mentioned in the beginning, I was distrustful of women, comparing out, and you're hitting on my man. And it was just easier to hang with the guys. And I had my one litter mate, Devin, who, she got sober two weeks after me, and she's, we stayed friends best friends ever since, and we still talk every day. And that's been such a gift. But about a couple of years into sobriety, I really felt like I could be doing better with the whole female friendship thing. So I made a concerted effort to develop those relationships, and I picked a handful of women, and I called them up like 2 years sober, and I'm like, "Do you want to be my friend?" Like pretty much. And they knew like we can do that in AA because we like they knew exactly where I was coming from. Like we can be awkward and weird because we've all been there, and a lot of those women are still my friends today. You know, it's tough sometimes. Sometimes friendships evolve and change, and they don't always stick forever, but when they do, it's pretty great. And what it's like now, I already touched on that. I guess I got about 5 minutes, so I'll kind of end with a couple things about what it's like now. The guy that I was dating when I was 2 months sober, I ended up marrying, and we just celebrated 5 years married last month. And so that worked out. It usually doesn't. But we very much grew up alongside each other in this program. I had no business being in a relationship in early sobriety. I was so selfish. I was so like, what can he do for me? Somebody said to me one day, like, what about waking up and asking, what can you do for him every day? And that was like mind blown. But it changed a lot for me. We took about 4 years before we decided to get married and had couples counseling and worked on things like finances and communication and all that. And we both prioritize Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's sober as well. I don't know if I mentioned that. We prioritize our spiritual well-being. My brother, who's doing much better now, was the officiant at our wedding, so that was really cool.
Cool.
It's yeah. So there's it's a true partnership with another human being. There's security and trust and respect and independence and not at all possible without Alcoholics Anonymous. And we run a business together. 5 years ago, I quit my corporate job to help him run his small business, and that's been awesome. We have a lot of gifts. We have flexibility of being business owners and get to travel. It also can be stressful. I tend to get in a lot of fear about when our like financial well-being is tied to this one thing. So it's a great opportunity to practice steps 10 and 11 every day. Into when I feel myself getting into that fear because of an employee not performing well, or a customer saying something threatening, or like a bad quarter or whatever, it's like I can pause and remember that I am taken care of no matter what. I have a higher power taking care of me and running the show, and accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Our home is a social gathering place for AA fellowship. We have a meeting at our house every week. We started during the pandemic. It's a literature-based meeting, and it's really strong group now. We have sober parties and poker nights, and like we have a good time. We are not a glum lot. We like to share our life with other alcoholics on the same path as us, and show the newcomer that we can have a good time. And so we open up our home because we have, the means and space to do so right now. What is the point of building a life if there's no one to share it with? And I'm able to maintain friendships today. And I think I was just looking for love and belonging in a bottle, like that whole time. And like I have it now here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I am a part of sober. It's pretty cool. The last thing I'll mention is that I always said I didn't want kids, and I'm 34, and my husband said the same thing, and we went into our marriage with that understanding. And I don't know, about a year ago, I went to him and I was like, so like I don't know, I'm struggling with this thing. And we took about a year and a half, actually, almost, and really like picking it up, putting it back down, prayer and meditation, discussion with our sponsors, our networks, there's a lot to consider with us. The details don't matter, but is this something we want to do? And you probably, I don't know if you can tell, but I'm 20 weeks along now, so that's exciting. I think my whole world's about to change, and my heart power is going to have to get a lot bigger. I'm, as much as I've grown in this program, like, I hate to admit it, like, but like, my life is, my world's pretty tight. Like, I have things the way I like them, or I my life is comfortable and convenient, and I'm about to become powerless over a lot. This little one's about to be running the show for a while, but I have sober, strong women, mothers, so many in my network, and so I know I'll be okay with them and with God, and God willing, my child won't have to see either of their parents take a drink. I was told to end at 7:05. So I hope you got something out of that. If you didn't, keep coming back. I'm sure you'll find someone you'll relate to. And I appreciate you having me out. Thanks for letting me speak.